Hey y'all, James Lee, alcoholic. Yeah. You guys look great. Isn't it great to be together again? Man, how about it? Woo! Like David was saying, it's been 2 long years, and so good to be in the room with you guys. You know, I'm so grateful that Alcoholics Anonymous, it seemed like overnight in March of 2020, went online so we could be in meetings together. Didn't it happen? It seemed like it overnight, wasn't it? And which I believe says everything you need to say about Alcoholics Anonymous, how we turned on a dime just like that, and makes me proud to be a member. And I'm so grateful for that, but I tell you, there's nothing like being in a room with people, is there? So, I don't know about you, but I can feel the energy in this. Anybody can feel that? Yeah. Woo! All right. Funny story. What time this meeting starts? 7:30. 7:12, I'm out in the lobby, and I'm about to come in here to find a seat to hear my wife talk tonight. I was really looking forward to it. By the way, she's my favorite AA speaker, you guys. So she'll be talking tomorrow night. Yeah. And I was real happy to have Friday, 9:30 a.m. I'm thinking, that's got to be the piece of cake. Nobody will be here. Give that talk. Get it over. Here I am. So anyway, Lee comes up. Lee, thank you very much for inviting us, by the way. Really appreciate that. It's a privilege to be here. Anyway, Lee comes up to me and he said, do you remember I called you and said that you're speaking on Friday and Jane's speaking Saturday night? And I said, maybe. So 7 minutes later, I got my suit on. Here we are. And by the way, you know, sometimes I get nervous given these. I had no time to do that. So here I am. And I have no idea what's going to happen. So here we go. I'll start with a few thank yous. Again, Lee, thank you very much for asking us to be here. David, great job. Appreciate you. And Darren, awesome voice. My wife says it all the time. The voice of the conference sets the tone, and you did. And that was the best dad joke I ever heard. I don't know about you guys. I loved it. So I have a joke. One joke. I have just one joke. But I made it up. You guys want to hear it? It's my only joke. So here it comes. I need your help. I start like this. I say, you know, my mom's a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and she's kind of well known. She does a lot of speaking in AA. And her name is Polly P. Anybody hear Polly P? Y'all hear her? Yeah. She's amazing. But help me out. Does anybody know what the P stands for? Pistol. Pistol. Polly Pistol. Now, y'all who know Polly Pistol know she's a pistol. Is she not? She's a pistol. Well, if you think she's a pistol now, you should have seen her loaded. That's my joke. That's my only joke. By the way, she loves that joke. She said, are you going to tell that joke this weekend? So, there it is. I've been sober since January 3rd, 1984. I got sober at the end. That's 38 years ago. I've had one sobriety date in Alcoholics Anonymous. I stayed out of here as long as I could, but I've had one. I got sober, I was 21 when I got sober. That puts me at 59 right now. And I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a sponsor. His name is Doug W. He lives in Wisconsin. And this past Valentine's Day, he celebrated 47 years of sobriety, so... And I'm so excited to be here to see Dick and Barbara and Belinda and Lee and everybody. So so glad to be here and be able to hang out with you guys. All right. You know, usually we start these talks with our first drink. So here it comes. You ready? I was 5. I got an early start. My first drink wasn't alcohol, but here's the story, okay? So this was 1967. And we're driving in our car. I think we're doing a road trip. And my dad's driving. My mom's in the passenger seat. I'm sitting behind my dad. And my brother, who was 7 at the time, is sitting right here. And I all of a sudden my mom leans over to my dad and she says, you know, James is, you know, he's usually bouncing around. He is really out of control in the back seat. I mean, I was bouncing around. I was like, I couldn't sit still. I was bothered, punching my brother, all kinds of stuff. And my mom said, this is not normal. And she goes, uh-oh. And so she reaches behind the seat, like right at my feet, and grabs her purse and pulls her purse up and pulls out this now empty bottle of pills that I had opened and ate all of them. Now, this is before childproof caps. Remember those days? I don't remember this. I guess it was a blackout for me, but I popped that off. And they got all exercised and rushed me to the hospital. And the doctor looked at me and said, well, I think it's too late to pump his stomach. Let's see what happens, you know. I lived. And I stayed sober for 10 years. So, white knuckle sobriety, man. I didn't need AA. Until I had my first drink. Now, let me tell you a little bit about what happened right before I took my first drink. My mom got sober in April 1977. And she went to a treatment center in Dallas, Texas, where they had this thing called Family Day. And we went into this Family Day meeting. And I think the whole purpose was, okay, kids, here's what alcoholism is. This is your mom. She's an alcoholic. Let me tell you a little bit about her, kind of what her deal is. And I was 14 and my brother was 16. And she started describing alcoholism and she laid out all these characteristics which I identified down the line. And I really hadn't had a drink yet. I mean, I did 10 years before, but I really hadn't had a drink. And I was identifying with everything she described as alcoholism. And then she said something really, really important. And by the way, I was really nervous about it. I mean, when someone describes alcoholism and you identify 100%, that's worrisome. And I was a smart kid and I was like, wow, this is not good. And then she said this. Now, I don't know if this is true. I haven't read it in any conference-approved literature. Okay, so this is not AA-approved information. But here's what she said. She said, if you are a child of an alcoholic, you have a 50-50 chance of being an alcoholic yourself. Now, she had just described alcoholism. I identified with everything she said. And I said to myself, I looked at my brother, you know, he's sitting right here. And I looked at myself and I said, it ain't going to be him. You know, 50-50, I know what that means. It ain't going to be him. So I knew that minute I would be an alcoholic if I drank. And that woman, that therapist who said that, gave me a gift. And that gift is what the big book describes as self-knowledge. Yeah. And what the big book says about self-knowledge is what? It ain't enough, man. Now, I took this information, this knowledge, and I said, I am never going to drink. Because if I drink, I'll become an alcoholic. And I knew what happened to alcoholics. Very briefly, you probably heard, if you've listened to my mom's talk, a few weeks before she got sober, she checked herself into a motel with a bottle of pills and a bottle of scotch, with the intent to die by suicide. She ate all that entire bottle of Valium and drank that bottle of scotch. And luckily she was found, whisked off in an ambulance to the hospital where she flatlined. So she was dead for a period of time. And they resuscitated her, and that was not her last drink. And while I was not in the ambulance ride, I knew about this. So here's what I knew at the age of 14. If you drink, you're going to die. Alcohol kills alcoholics. If you're an alcoholic and you drink, and I'm going to be an alcoholic, which means if I drink, it's going to eventually kill me. I knew this at the age of 14. So I said, I'm never going to drink. Smart kid, never going to drink. And I didn't drink for 5 months, right? I didn't drink for five. I held out. And then I had my first real drink, which also was an alcohol. I'll just share this straight up. I have a story which includes outside issues, and I know this is Alcoholics Anonymous. I identify as an alcoholic, but let me just share. I smoked a lot of weed. I did a lot of coke. I took a lot of pills. Favorites of mine in the 80s were Quaaludes. Remember those? They're about that big. Woo! All right. I'll never forget. I took two of those with my buddy, and we went bar hopping at happy hour. I did not remember after the second bar. But anyway, so this first experience wasn't alcohol. I'm not going to go into the details, but rolling papers were involved. Doesn't matter. Anyway, I show up to school one day, and this is September 1977. And if any of y'all were there, weren't y'all there in 1977? Yeah. Does anyone remember 1977? I don't remember much of you do. All right. So here's what 1977, sex, drugs, rock and roll, right? That's what it was all about. The music was Led Zeppelin and Rush and all these bands that I was into. I love music. I love rock and roll. And I love the other two things, too. But anyway, So I show up at school. Let me tell you about this kid that I brought to my first drink. I don't know if anyone you can relate to this, but I believe this was the symptoms of my alcoholism before I took my first drink. I showed up to school and I felt the same way I felt my entire life up to this moment. And that is, I felt apart from, less than, unloved and unlovable. I felt like there was something really wrong with me. I felt that there was kind of a secret to life that everyone learned but me. I remember hanging out with all these kids thinking, I didn't know that they didn't know anything either, but I was thinking, these kids know how to live and I don't. And as I said, I felt like there was something wrong with me. And where this, so it was a kind of a, I had this the mental thinking, mind of an alcoholic, that I had up to this point and continue to have. And I had the emotions of an alcoholic, which means my emotions went up and down like this. And I had this feeling that there was something really wrong with me. And I felt all of this physically right here. I'm pointing to right behind my sternum. This is where I felt it. And I felt it as an ache. It was like a chronic, constant ache that I walked around with. And it got to be, I didn't even know I had it. It's just something that I lived with. And I believe that chronic ache and all my thinking and all of my emotions is because of sort of underneath all that is I have a spiritual malady. And I had a spiritual malady from the time I can remember. And so I show up to school this day, and this guy comes up to me. His name is David. And I didn't know this guy. Let me describe him to you. He was a senior. I was a sophomore. And he walked up to me, had really long hair. And you remember 1977? Think Robert Plant. You guys, lead singer Led Zeppelin, that was his hair. That's what this dude had. And he actually had a Led Zeppelin t-shirt on because they were touring that summer. And they actually played both Fort Worth and Dallas. I was living in a suburb of Fort Worth, Texas called Hearst, Texas. And I was at the school, L.D. Bell High School in Bedford, Texas. Anyway, he comes up to me with the shirt, the hair, and the very red eyes. And he says, "You want to come with me?" And I said, "I don't know who you are. I don't know where you're going. I don't know what you're going to do, but let's go." And that's exactly what I did. So we went. What we did was basically, this is lunchtime. We left the school. We crossed the street. That street's Brown Trail, Bedford, Texas. Across the street were some woods. There was a clearing with these logs in a circle. And we did what teenagers did in that clearing for years and years. And I'm going to tell you something. Just like that, my life changed. Just like that. You know, this kid who felt apart from, less than, different, unloved and unlovable, I fit. I belonged. I was a part of. I had friends. David was my new best friend. I know him for 5 minutes. New best friend. And I wanted what he had. And I said to myself, I'm going to get what he has. And so I started to get what he has, right? What did I do? I started going to rock and roll shows and buying those t-shirts. I started growing my hair out. And I was basically loaded all the time. And let me tell you a little bit about my hair when I grew my hair out. Because you guys need to know this. When I had hair, years ago, it was curly. right? Now back then, the hair was long and, you know, flowing like this. So I started growing it, but my curly hair started to grow like this. And so I looked a little bit different. And I was like, dang it, I wanted to be Robert Plant. I'm not getting there. But anyway, I strove to be like David. And, you know, in the big book, it describes alcoholism as a physical allergy and having the mind of an alcoholic, combined with the mind of an alcoholic. Let me tell you something about this physical allergy for me. That day, when I did that with those kids, it was like a fire hose turned on. Just like that, man. It was like, it was on. And I was drunk or under some influence every day for 6.5 years. I'm not one of these guys who was a social drinker on the weekends. Didn't start like that for me. It started every day, all day long. And you know, I was 15 years old. And you say, well, how's a 15-year-old get enough to drink all day long? Oh, we can do that, can't we? Yeah, it's not that hard. First of all, my parents, my dad was in the military. And I don't know if you know this, but folks in the military can drink. He was in the Air Force. And he had. They used to have dinner parties and stuff. So there was a cabinet full of liquor. That when I started out, I started with Southern Comfort, and I eventually Jack and Coke became my drink. I also, at the age of 15, I was able to. I basically get whatever I needed, and I did that every day for 6.5 years. I'm going to tell you this straight up. I don't have a super exciting story. Not a lot of drama happened. I will say this, I knew about alcoholism and I knew about AA. Let me tell you a little bit about how I knew about AA. When my mom got sober in April 77, she joined Alcoholics Anonymous and she dragged us kids to AA meetings at the Harbor Club in Fort Worth, Texas. Every Sunday morning there was a speaker and we would go. And I was a kid and I learned a couple things. First thing I learned was AA is full of losers. I'm going to tell you, when I was 14, you guys were losers, right? No wonder you go to AA to be with each other. Where else are you going to get? It's unbelievable. And then my mom was like, rah, rah, AA. And I'm like, oh yeah, this is exactly, no, I'm not into this at all. But I did hear these incredible stories. And what I learned as a 14-year-old is that to be an alcoholic, you have to be homeless and go to prison, get divorced, wreck your cars, lose a bunch of jobs. And none of that happened to me in my sobriety, in my drinking. None of that. I was not homeless. I did live in my car. Actually, I got to tell you this. We were in Illinois last weekend. And this guy got up and he said something that was very profound. He said, if you ever slept in a house where your name was not on the lease, you're homeless. And that's, and I was like, oh, you're telling me every time I slept on somebody's couch, I was homeless? Then I was homeless. It's homeless. I didn't wreck my car. I wrecked my car in a little bit. It's one of those kind of little wrecks. In Texas, we called them whiskey dents. You guys have whiskey dents up here, out here? You got those, all right. Where you just sort of clip the telephone pole or just kind of sideswipe the car just a little bit. That was my car. I never went to prison. I never got arrested, which is really quite a miracle because I committed multiple felonies on a daily basis for 3 years. And I never got arrested. Thank God. Otherwise, I've been in prison. And now I have been to prison. Sober. And because I take meetings into the prison in outside of Tallahassee there. And I remember going into the prison. And I sort of felt like I didn't belong. You know, I don't know if anyone's done corrections work that's ever actually never experienced the correction experience. But. And I'd say to the guys, I don't know if I've never been to prison. I don't know if I have anything to share with you guys. And they go, you've never been to prison? I said, no. And they go, we want what you have, you know? So I'll just say this. If not experienced. experiencing incarceration is keeping you from doing work in the prisons and jails, don't let it stop you. Go do that work. It's amazing. Anyway, so none of those things happened. So I was able to convince myself I wasn't an alcoholic. But here's the other thing. I had a serious attitude about AA. Not only did I think AA was full of losers, but when I was 15 and my mom kind of discovered that her youngest son was out there drinking and working up his alcoholic story, she started telling me things. Okay, and I'm going to share this with you guys. This is what I experienced. But if you have kids who are starting their drinking, don't say this to them. That's my suggestion. Don't say this. You ready? Here's what she would say to me. My mom, James, we're saving a seat for you in AA. I can't wait for you to get here. You can join my home group. I've got this sponsor. His name's Mark. He's going to sponsor you. He's great. And you and I will trudge this road of happy destiny together. Now, she didn't say this once. She said it repeatedly for years. Now, put yourself in my shoes, y'all. Empathize with me. I'm 15, 16, 17, 18 years old. And my mom is saying, can't wait for you to join AA. What is the last place I want to do? What is the last thing I want to do? Join AA. He's like, oh, you think I'm going to join AA? I don't think so. And here's what I convinced myself. You are an alcoholic because you can't control it. But I'm different. Huh? The battle cry of every alcoholic there is, right? My case is different. You watch me. I'm going to beat this thing. And I literally tried to beat this thing for 6.5 years and I lost. But this belligerent defiance that I had towards my mom's message, and I believe she did this because she loved me and really meant well. But I was an alcoholic and belligerent, and the message I received was, AA is the last place I'm going to go. Right? So, fast forward to the end of my drinking. It's December 31st, 1984. And I went to a party in Fort Worth, Texas. It was at someone's house. I don't remember whose house. I don't remember the house. All I remember of the house is the front porch. And the reason I remember it is because I was really drunk. I was going to get sick, and I came outside. I was trying to make it to the bushes over here. There's like a porch railing, and I was crawling to make it to the railing, and I blacked out. And the next thing I know, I come to on January 3rd, 1984. And something had happened to me that day. I came to, and something was in my mind that was not in my mind before that moment. And let me tell you what was in my mind before that moment. And I believe it was on January 2nd. I was in a blackout, so I'm not 100% on this. And I believe it was on January 1st. And I know it was on December 31st and before that. And that's this. In my mind, I'm not an alcoholic. I am not an alcoholic. I had been able to convince myself that because all these things hadn't happened to me, I'm not an alcoholic. And the second thing, I want to be drunk. That's the way it was for me. And that's the way I live my life. Let me tell you just a little bit about towards the end, before this party. I was one of those guys who loved to go to the parties, who loved to hang out with his friends and get drunk. And I remember we used to go to Lake Grapevine in Grapevine, Texas, and we used to party up there all the time. And at the end, what I would do is I basically had isolated myself from everyone. How did that come about? I pushed them all out of my life. And I was alone. And I felt the loneliness of an alcoholic. And the way it looked for me was I'd get up in the morning, I'd get whatever I needed for that day, a bottle, a six-pack, whatever. And I would get behind the wheel of my car and I would drive. And I was literally going nowhere. I called it driving around and drinking. And so I drove, not only did I drive drunk a lot, I drove drunk all day, every day, for months, the end of 1977. And that's what alcohol had done. My alcoholism, it had caused me to push out of my life everyone who cared about me. And I found myself completely alone. Go to this party. I'm not an alcoholic. I want to be drunk. I come to January 3rd, and I'm an alcoholic. And that is a miracle. I don't know how that happened. All I know is it happened. And a second miracle happened. I wanted to be sober. And here was my experience. I came to, and I'm like, man, I'm an alcoholic. And I had this realization. And I love that word realization because it's like got reality in it, right? I was in reality for a moment. And the reality was, hey man, I'm alcoholic and I want to be sober. And I think to myself, I'm 21, what do you do? You know, I didn't know what to do. So I did something really lame. And I'll share it with y'all if you promise not to judge me. Okay, you promise? Okay, here it comes. Ready? I called my mom. Tough guy. And this is when phones had wires, right? The base where you dial. At least they were numbers, you know, the dial pad. So I phoned my mom and I said, hey, mom, you're not going to believe this. I'm an alcoholic. And she said, hey, James, no kidding, you know. I've known this for years. And I said, and mom, I want what you have. I want to be sober. And she goes, oh my God, I've been praying for this day. And I go, here comes this God stuff. And she said, James, if you want what I have and you want to be sober, you need to go to AA. And I said, mom, I don't want it that bad. And I hung up the phone. Like, I still think about that. God's like, hey man, you're an alcoholic. You need help. Okay, I'll call my mom. She gives me help, and I say no thanks. Here's what I think happened. And I didn't know this until many years later, but I believe that that day this is what happened. When I came to on January 3rd, God had surrendered me. You hear me? He had surrendered me. I didn't do anything. I just came to in a state of surrender. And I want you guys to know, I knew it was over. I was like, I'm done. I'm done. And I haven't had a drink since. I'm done. And I want sobriety. I don't want to live the way I was living. And God had surrendered me. Now, I've heard stories in AA. My mom's husband, Dave, perfect story, perfect example of this. Dave was drinking a fifth of vodka every day. And he started going to a therapist. He's living in Dallas, Texas. And he went to a therapist who said, go to AA. So Dave started to go to AA drunk. He'd drink on the way to the meeting. He'd drink on the way home. And these fine people in this group in Dallas, Texas said to him, Dave, if you want to get sober, we can't help you. You need God's help. And he said, I don't believe in God. And they said, we don't care. Go ask for help. And one day he said, I'm going to give it a try. He said, God, I don't believe you in you, but if you're there, will you please help me? And the next day was his sobriety day. Now, that's not my story. My story is, I was not an alcoholic and wanted to be drunk. And the next day, I was an alcoholic and didn't want to be drunk anymore. And that was a miracle. And then 5 minutes later, I get on the phone, right? So I'm surrendered, right? God surrendered me. Mom, she said, go to AA. No, click. 5 minutes, I unsurrendered myself. Anybody do that? Unsurrender yourself? My ego reconstructed itself like that. And I took that back. I took all my will and I took it all back just like that. And I hear this great analogy. Peg M from Nebraska is where I heard this. She said that her surrender moment was like throwing in the towel. Have you guys heard of this analogy, throwing the towel? So it comes from boxing. So the boxer's in the ring. His opponent is beating him up bad. So my opponent, alcoholism, beat me up real bad. My manager in the corner, God, says, "This ain't your night, kid. It's over for you." Throws in the towel. Surrenders. And I was like, that was my experience. 5 minutes later, what did I do? I reached in and I grabbed that towel back. And I said, "This is my towel. And I want it back." And let me tell you guys this. I identify with the physical allergy that's described in our big book. I identify with the alcoholic mind that's described in the big book. So that, I believe, qualifies me as an alcoholic for this program. But I'm going to tell you why I really qualify, why I really believe I'm an alcoholic. It's the following year, the entire year of 1984. Here's what happened. I'm not going to AA, and I didn't go to AA. What I did was I said, here's what I know. I know I'm an alcoholic. I know I'm done drinking. I got this. I'm going to do it on my own. Anybody try to get sober on your own? It's all me, man. I can do it. I don't need help. And here's what happened. Here's what I thought. I don't know if anyone identifies with this. I thought this. Alcohol is my problem. Take away alcohol, problem solved. Right? It's like kindergarten, isn't it? Take away my problem, problem solved. But here's what I learned over the next year. Alcohol was not my problem. And as a matter of fact, alcohol was the answer to all of my problems. When I was 15 years old and I picked up that first one, what I found that day was the answer to every problem I had. And every time I drank, it gave me the answer to every problem I had. And here's what the problem was. I had this alcoholic mind, and I had this feeling right behind here that was chronically a chronic ache. I drank, my mind would quiet down, and I could breathe. I could take a breath. And I didn't know it as I was drinking. I thought, oh, I'm just partying, having a good time. But what I was doing is I was using the second best treatment I ever found for alcoholism, and that's alcohol. Because it did treat my alcoholism. And so here I am, January 3rd, my solution taken away from me. And I'm thinking, problem solved? No. I spend the next year getting sicker and sicker and sicker. And I don't know if any of you guys have ever tried this, getting sober on your own, trying to learn how to live life sober without going to AA meetings or any sort of treatment. I got really sick. I'm talking about really sick, you guys. I was emotionally sick. My emotions were like this. I could be, I could be rageful at 1 minute and completely, paralyzingly depressed the next. I could, the alcoholic mind was just racing like crazy. And I don't know about you guys, but I had these voices in my head. And these voices would talk to me, and they never said good things about me. And it started to get louder and louder and louder over this year. And the worst thing was right here. This feeling I had came back with a vengeance, and it got worse. And it felt like this spring was tightening behind in my chest. And I was so incredibly uncomfortable and in such spiritual pain. I knew one thing, is I was going to drink eventually. But here I am, belligerent alcoholic. I'm not going to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm telling you guys, this is the last place I was going to go. I would find an answer that wasn't AA. So I'm saying to this, if there's anybody here that doesn't want to be here, welcome. Seriously. I'm serious about this. Welcome. I didn't want to be here. But here's what happened. Through that year, I would occasionally go to an AA meeting. I knew where they were. I knew how to get to them. I knew how they were run. But here's how I was in AA meetings. I don't know if anyone relates to this. But I'd come in late, and I'd leave early. Anybody else? I'd sit in the back row of the meeting. In the back row of the meeting, my sponsor, Frank Honeycutt, used to say, was the shoe section You guys hear about this? Why? Because the loafers and the sneakers and the slippers sit back there. Present company excluded, you guys. But that's where I sat in the back. And that's exactly what I was. I was a slipper waiting to happen. And I didn't get a big book. I had read the thing. I thought it was stupid. I didn't get a sponsor. I didn't hang out with people. But I knew how to get to a meeting. So one day, this woman named Barbara called me up. And she said, James, I knew Barbara. Let me tell you why I knew Barbara. She was the mother of some friends I used to party with. And she actually lived right behind us. There was our house, a fence, her house, and her kids. And I used to jump that fence and run around with her sons. And she called. She got sober. And she called me and said, hey, I have a sponsee. She needs to get to a meeting. I've called everybody I know. Nobody can take her. Will you please take her? And I found myself doing something really weird for me. Why? Because I'm a selfish, self-centered alcoholic. And I do things for me because I want to do them for me because I'm going to get something out of it. And I said, for some reason, I said to her, okay, I'll take her. I don't know this person, but I'll take her. So here's what I did, you guys. I got my car. I was given this address. I went over to a part of town I'd never been to pick up someone I didn't know, to go to a meeting in this neighborhood that I'd never been to. And I sat at a table. The way the meeting was laid out, I was like, see these two tables? They were pushed together with chairs around it. And I sat down. It just so happened that right across from me was the speaker. I'd never seen him before in my life. I haven't seen him since. And that guy was the guy giving the talk that night. And I'm going to tell you something about this guy. I don't remember his name, but here's what I remember. He looked a lot like me. He drank like me. He liked the same music I like. He had the same experiences I had. But there's one big difference. This dude was happy, joyous, and free. And I was dying. And what was the difference between happy, joyous, and free and dying? The 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And for some reason, that message got delivered to me. That if I want to be happy, there's an answer. And the answer is the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that day, this was about a year of, what did we call it? Slowbriety. You ever heard of that? So a year of that. Oh, no, it's so dryety was what I was practicing. Because I was dry as could be. And that day I joined Alcoholics Anonymous. And that day was the beginning of my recovery. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about all that. The first thing I'll say is that my recovery, especially the early years, was slow. The book says sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. Sometimes slowly, standing up right here. It took a while, years really, for me to come out of the fog and feel like I was starting to get better. Now I'm going to tell you this. The people in the meetings saw that I started to get better right away. You ever notice that? Newcomers come to your group and you see them when they get there, and then say a month later there's something very different about them. And you see it in the eyes, don't you? And they could see it in me long before I could see it in myself, just like the book says. So I started to change, again, slowly. And part of my change was I immediately went back to college. I'd been a college dropout. It's hard to, make good grades when you drank like I did. So I dropped out of college. And like a week sober, I decided I'm going back to school. Now, I heard in AA, don't make too many changes, right, the first year. My experience, I'm glad I didn't listen to that. I'm glad I changed right away. I went back to school, and here's what I learned about school, you guys. I was pretty good at it. You know why? I showed up. You know how when you show up for class, you actually learn stuff? When you do homework, you actually make grades, And I found out I was pretty smart. And have you ever heard that in Alcoholics Anonymous? Alcoholics have above average intelligence. You hear that in AA, right? Oh, you don't hear that in Al-Anon. I'll tell you that right now. But you might hear that in AA. So I was like, okay, I'm going to grasp onto that. Did college, did pretty darn good, and graduated. And when I graduated, I was, let's see, it was 1987. I was 25 years old. So I took the long route to get a college degree. And I got a job, and then I got a phone call. And the phone call was this guy offering me a job in Illinois. So I had gone to the University of Texas in Arlington, Texas. So I moved up to Illinois, and I worked for this company up there. And what part of the deal was they sent me to grad school, and they said, here's our deal. You work 2 days a week. You go to school 3 days a week. You can go to any school in the area. I picked Northwestern in Evanston, Illinois, and he said, we'll pay for everything. And I was like, how does that happen? How does that happen? Just a couple of years ago, I was a college dropout, running my life into the ground in a constant state of misery. And just a few years later, I've got this deal where I'm going to Northwest, Big Ten University. Can you believe that? So I did that. What happened in Illinois? I did the, life began to happen. I met someone, got married, started having kids, three kids total. And Jane asked me to talk about this, so I'm going to tell this story. This was 1993. Okay, I was 9 years sober. Life was good, you guys. It was real good. I was happy. I had everything I wanted. I had this great job, married, nice home, lived in a wonderful place, Evanston, Illinois, and wife gets pregnant. Amazing. Out comes Ryan in May of 1993. And I'm going to tell you, he was perfect. I remember people used to say, I remember them saying to me before Ryan was born, do you want a boy? Do you want a girl? And I said, I don't care. I just want a healthy baby. Just please, God, give me a healthy baby. Out comes Ryan, 10 fingers, 10 toes, perfect. And he was gorgeous. He had this blonde, curly hair that was just, he looked like an angel. And he was just the light of my life. And then a few months go on, and we begin to realize there's something wrong with Ryan. And so we started getting him tested. And a few months after the tests were started, the news came in. Ryan is profoundly deaf. Now, what I'm about to say to you is said because I was ignorant. Do you hear me? I didn't know better. And here was my reaction. And I'm ashamed to share this, but I have to share it because it's the truth. When that doctor said, your son is profoundly deaf, 9 years sober, 10 years by this time, here was my first thought. How is this going to affect me? What is going to happen with my life? Now, you know, my son is a year old. And we learn he's profoundly deaf. And I'm thinking about myself. Selfishness, self-centeredness, that is the root of our troubles. And then the next thought that came into my mind was, and this is the thought out of ignorance, Ryan's life is going to be so small. Right? He's deaf. He's going to have to go to special schools. He's going to have a small little job, a small little life. And I say that out of I thought that because I was ignorant. All right. And I get on the phone to my sponsor after I find this information, and I share all this with him, and he says, it's time to get to work. So he and I got to work doing the steps, and we got to work getting language to my son. So I learned sign language. Still know it today. Got the information to Ryan. Started to send him to a special school. He was having none of that. So we ended up mainstreaming him in the schools in Evanston. And it was great. It was a great experience. He went to this elementary school. This would be the elementary school he would have normally gone to. Had this amazing set of teachers. And a really great experience. And then comes graduation. Right? He's what? 12? Sixth grade. And I got to tell you this story. I've never seen anything like it. This grammar school had a graduation ceremony. Can you believe that? You ever hear? Do they do that here? I've never heard of it. So I moved it, and they have. And I'm like, okay. So what? Then right before the ceremony, the principal came up to me, my wife and I, and said, "I had this idea, and I was wanting to see if this is okay with you. I'm going to read the name of these sixth graders for them to come up and get their diploma. I wanted to invite Ryan up on the stage to fingerspell their name." And we said, "We'll talk to him." So we talked to Ryan. He said, "Sure." So we go to this ceremony. It comes this time. The principal gets up on the stage and he says, "I want to bring up Ryan L. to come up on the stage. Let me tell you about Ryan." And he starts talking about my kid. And here's what he's saying. "Ryan has changed the school. Everyone in this school is different because he's been here. He's the only deaf kid in this school, and everybody has just loves him and thinks he's amazing, and we're all sorry to see him go." And I was blown away, you guys. First of all, we didn't have a graduation ceremony when I was in grammar school. If we did, nobody would be on stage saying stuff like that about me, right? They'd be saying, "James, don't let the door hit you on the way out. See ya." But they're saying this about my kid. And so I started to, you know how we sometimes are. I'm sitting out in the audience, watching my son fingerspell these names, and tears started to come to my eyes. I was ready to let go. I couldn't do that, though. I was in public, right? I've got to be a strong man. So I'm hanging in there, waiting for this thing to be over. As soon as it's over, I run home. And I burst into, I kind of close the door, make sure I'm all by myself. Burst into tears. I hit my knees and I say to God, "God, how does this happen to a guy like me?" And I remember when 10 years before, when we learned about Ryan's deafness, my fist was in the air to God. "God, why are you doing this to me? What did I ever do to deserve this?" That was my selfish, self-centered, alcoholic mind. 10 years later, I'm on my knees saying, "God, what did I ever do to deserve this? What did I ever do to deserve this?" I'm going to tell you something. From fist in the air to on my knees is what I would call a profound alteration to my reaction to life. And how I got from fist in the air to on my knees is the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. That day when I shared that with my sponsor, we started working those steps, my life changed. And I began a trajectory that it was rocketed, as the book talks about. And so let me give you an update on Ryan, because a lot of people, if I don't tell this part, a lot of people ask about him. So remember when I said he's going to have a small, kind of little life, and this little job and everything? I'm going to tell you, I was wrong. And I am so happy I was wrong. And let me tell you this. There was a lot of years where I could not say I was wrong. Anybody like that? I have to be right all the time. Well, I'm going to tell you right now, I was wrong. And what freedom it is to know that. Because let me tell you about him. He was mainstreamed through his school. He graduated high school. He got accepted to Rochester Institute of Technology in Rochester, New York. By the way, I could not get into that school. He studied civil engineering. He graduated, got a job, got a better job, got a better job. And right now he's living in Philadelphia, building train stations in Delaware. And pretty soon he's going to move to Fort Collins, Colorado, and oversee all these civil engineering projects in the West. Can you believe that? And here I am. Yeah, give him a hand for that. And here I am, thinking wrongly, because I'm ignorant, that his life is going to be small. And he, I thought he'd never leave Evanston, Illinois. He has traveled the world. I remember when he was 21 years old, he texted me and he said, "Dad, I'm going to go to Indonesia for 3 weeks." And I said, "Really? who are you going with? He said, well, I was going to go with my girlfriend, but she can't go, so I'm going by myself. And I was thinking to myself, I don't know about you guys, but when I was 21, there was no way I could go to Indonesia for 3 weeks by myself. But here's my son. Off he goes. Has a great time. So his life is big. And he is amazing. And he is my greatest teacher. He's my greatest teacher. So he's 28, almost. He'll be, let's see, 9, 30. Is that right? Or is he about to be 29? I can't do the math. 28. He's about to be 28. Chris is about to be 25. He currently lives on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. He is living his best life. And my daughter's 22. She graduated about a year ago from college. And she texted me today to tell me that she just got accepted to her second nursing program. She wants to be a nurse. So I'm so proud of her. So those are my kids. And I'm going to tell you, I love my kids. My kids love me. Amazing gift in my life. Some of the other gifts I have in my life is I have a great job that I love, that I'm very good at. And I'm one of those people who's been a remote worker for like 10 years. So when everything shut down, it was no big deal for me to work from. I was already a remote worker. And I love what I do. And I'm so I love that part of my life. I live in a wonderful home. I have the respect of my peers. People, I love people and people love me, and that's because of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to tell you, when I came here, when I was struck sober, and for that year I lived trying to fix myself, none of that was true, you guys. There was nothing in my life worth living. So for me to tell you that I'm a completely different person today than when I came here is not a lie. And but my greatest gift in this life is my amazing wife, Jane. And you're going to hear her talk tomorrow night. As I mentioned, she's my favorite AA speaker. So do not miss Jane. She's amazing. And she tells this story. So I'm going to leave it to you to tell. But let's just say that I knew Jane before I knew Jane. Because you ever hear the CD of the Month clubs? You know, the folks who record these events. If you join these CD of the Month clubs, this is back when CDs were a thing, they would ship them out. And so I'm still a member of this club, so I still get these CDs every month. Well, one day, it was about 2003, in comes the CD. Jane from Tallahassee. I'm like, who's this? Throw that in the CD player. And I was, by the end of this talk, I was in tears and I was thinking, this woman is amazing. I hope one day to meet her. And I have to tell you, I got a little bit of a crush on her. From afar, never met her. I kind of fell for her spirit. You'll see what I mean tomorrow night. And which was very uncomfortable because I was married at the time. So, but I did. I'd never met her or whatever. And she'll talk about when we met in 2004. But we have a great life. We love each other. And Lee, thank you for inviting the two of us, because we love to do these things together. I mean, it's really a privilege. So she's my greatest gift in this life. But I'm going to tell you that all these gifts are wonderful gifts of Alcoholics Anonymous. But let me tell you the greatest gift that I found here. And if you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, let me say this. You're not promised a college degree. You're not promised a spouse. You're not promised a good job. Now, these things happen to many of us. What I have experienced personally and what I have seen is when a person changes spiritually, their outside world begins to change. That's what I've seen. But these things aren't promised us. But I'm going to tell you what is promised us. And it's promised us in this all through the book, but it's specifically in Step 12. And Step 12 says, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. And this is the greatest gift I've gotten in Alcoholics Anonymous. When I was a kid, you know, before I took my first drink at the age of 5 even, I believed in God. I had an experience of God. I had a belief in God. I believed God exists. I believed God loved me. And I didn't believe what I heard in the church that I was taken to. But that didn't matter because I believed God was there, existed, and loved me. And what happened was, is at the age of 15, I found alcohol. And by the age of 21 and a half, that feeling, that experience, that knowledge was gone. I no longer believed in God. I no longer believed He existed or cared anything about me. And I had pushed all that out of my mind. What I like to think about. And by the way, I did that through my behavior, through my actions, through my drinking, through the people I hurt. I pushed God out of my life. And what I like to think about it is like there was this light, there was a candle burning in right inside, right behind my sternum. In that space was this candle, which was God, and I just threw my alcoholism, just blew it out. And I found myself at the end, spiritually bankrupt. And it happened so slowly, I didn't even know what happened. And so I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I start working the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I began to be given the gift, the promise, that's promised there in step 12, as a result of working the steps. And here's what I learned. You know that candle that was inside that I thought I'd burned out? What I realized is that it is impossible for me to remove God from within me. That's impossible. You know, it says in the big book, deep within every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. That fundamental idea of God is within me, and there's nothing I can do to make that not be there. But what I can do is I can cover it up. And there's a line in the big book that says, I'm going to butcher it here, but we got to the point where that it was obscured by calamity, pomp, and worship of other things. And so the spirit inside me was obscured. Isn't that an amazing word? It was covered up. And this reminds me of one of my favorite AA speakers, Chuck Chamberlain, used to say. He said, Alcoholics Anonymous is about uncovering, discovering, and discarding. And what I did was I was able to uncover, unobscure, and discover that that spirit was there the whole time. It was I who was away. And what Alcoholics Anonymous did was slowly, over time, bring me back to this relationship with this power. And that is what's promised with Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, it says in the big book that my job here tonight is to, in my own words, and from my own point of view, share with you how I established my relationship with God and how I established it, or I should say, reestablished it, because it was there, was the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and find people like you. And I am so grateful to be here. I'm so grateful we're together. I'm so grateful we're here to share the spirit of sobriety at Alcoholics Anonymous. And I say, let's have a great weekend. Love y'all.